Welcome to the Physiological Reviews podcast. Today, we will discuss an editorial titled Pregnancy and the SARS-CoV-2 Pandemic that was published in the July 2022 issue of the journal. Joining us are Editor-in-Chief Dr. Sadi Madelon, Senior Author Professor Hilary Critchley, and co-authors Professor Rebecca Reynolds and Professor Sarah Stock. Dr. Madelon, over to you.
Welcome to the Physiological Reviews podcast. I am Dr. Sadi Madelon, Editor-in-Chief of Physiological Reviews. I am delighted to be joined today by three outstanding clinician scientists who have contributed an editorial in Physiological Reviews entitled Pregnancy and the SARS-CoV-2 Pandemic. Before I introduce our distinguished speakers, I would like to comment that I am very, very impressed by the University of Edinburgh, which was established in 1583, and among its distinguished alumni include Dr. Charles Darwin, Dr. Arthur Conan Doyle, one of my favorite authors, and David Hume, whose essays I have read extensively. You have 19 Nobel Prize winners. What is not very well known, that you have a Fields Medalist. And for those of you who study maths in college, a Fields Medalist is the ultimate achievement in life. Now, the senior author on the editorial is Professor Hilary Critchley. Professor Critchley has held a personal chair in reproductive medicine at the University of Edinburgh since 1999. She is head of the Deanery of Clinical Sciences at the University of Edinburgh. She is co-director of the Medical Research Council Center for Reproductive Health, and she is consulting gynecologist at the Royal Infirmary in Edinburgh. Her research has been aimed at improving our understanding of basic science of the uterine endometrium. In particular, her research has focused on the clinical management of gynecological complaints that have a major effect on the quality of life. She is a fellow of numerous academic and professional organizations, including the Royal Society of Edinburgh and the Royal Society of Biology. She has published more than 200 articles in peer-reviewed journals, and she is an associate editor for Physiological Reviews. Dr. Critchley, we thank you so much for everything you're doing to take care of very sick people and for your service and time to Physiological Reviews.
Thank you.
Professor Rebecca Reynolds is professor of metabolic medicine at the University of Edinburgh. Her research has looked at the ways in which early development in utero can affect health and disease later. Her work also has involved conducting experimental medicine studies in pregnant women, mechanistic studies of the placenta, and randomized control trials that investigate ways to improve outcome during pregnancy. In addition, she manages a clinic that serves women with metabolic problems in pregnancy. Professor Reynolds, we thank you for your service to humanity, and we are grateful to you for co-authoring this editorial and taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.
Finally, but not least, Professor Sarah Stock is professor of maternal and fetal health at the University of Edinburgh. She is also consultant obstetrician and subspecialist in maternal and fetal medicine at the Royal Infirmary of Edinburgh. Professor Sarah Stock has been recently appointed to the role of program director for In Utero Welcome Leap. My warmest congratulations to you, Professor Stock, and thank you so much for everything you have been doing in taking care of very sick pregnant women and for taking the time to be with us.
It's a pleasure.
Her research examines efforts at reducing preterm birth, stillbirth, and other complications in pregnancy. And for every parent, the idea that there is stillbirth is the anathema. Her work pays particular attention to the use of antenatal corticosteroids, perinatal outcomes during pandemic, methods of induction in labor, and medications used during pregnancy.
Thank you.
In the context of the current discussion, Professor Sarah Stock has led pivotal clinical studies in the field of pregnancy and SARS-CoV-2 infection and COVID-19 vaccination. And of course, Dr. Reynolds and Dr. Critchley are world leaders in their field. I would like to welcome the three of you to the discussion. You recently published an editorial in Physiological Reviews that evaluated our knowledge of COVID-19 in pregnancy. To begin, let me ask you a question concerning the efficacy of vaccination in diminishing the severity and long-term consequences of COVID-19. Dr. Stock, do you recommend that women that are pregnant receive the COVID vaccine?
Yes, thank you. I absolutely do recommend it. There's now good evidence that women who are pregnant are more likely to have severe COVID-19 than women in the general population. And by that, I mean more likely to be admitted to intensive care units, more likely to require ventilation, and sadly, more likely to die as well. Their babies are also at higher risk of complication, preterm birth and stillbirth. And vaccination is the safest and most effective way for women of all ages and backgrounds to protect themselves and their babies against COVID-19 infection. And it's really important that we recognise that pregnant women can be vaccinated at any stage in pregnancy to protect themselves and their babies. Really important as we are now moving again into autumn booster season in the Northern Hemisphere, certainly, and pregnant women have been recognised again as a vulnerable group. So we want to highlight that position that pregnant women should be vaccinated.
Thank you so much. And of course, every mother and every parent is very interested in the health of their child. And that's wonderful to hear that you protect the babies as well. Are there any significant side effects to the mother or to the unborn fetus by any of the vaccines?
Yeah, of course, it's really important to look at this, and it is a worry for parents. The side effects in pregnancy seem to be exactly the same as they are in the general population for women. So I think many people will be aware of these, usually mild and self-limiting, fever, some discomfort in the vaccination site, that kind of sort of mild, short-lived side effect. We've done work using Scottish data, and it supports data coming out from a large number of countries now, all of which have been reassuring that COVID vaccination has no other negative effects on either fertility, pregnancy, or newborn health. And an example of that is, you know, our data from Scotland, and remembering, as you know, we're a small country with only a population of about 5.5 million. We've given more than 40,000 vaccines in pregnancy since the start of the vaccination programme. That's to the end of March, so we're going up higher than that now, and no safety concerns have been found.
Thank you so much. Professor Critchley, would you like to add to this?
Yes, thank you, Sarah. Professor Stock, thank you for sort of highlighting such important points for women as they journey through the life course of pregnancy. And what I would like to add is that there are some very recent and very reassuring data about the safety of vaccination and concerns pregnant patients may have in the context of miscarriage or risk of ectopic pregnancy. Indeed, the factors that have been contributor to hesitancy about vaccines among those who are pregnant or planning pregnancy has been hitherto the very limited data on the safety of COVID-19 vaccines in the early weeks of pregnancy. And I commend my colleague, Professor Sarah Stock, and the team she has been working with on a very recent study. It is currently in preprint format. Now, what that means is that the data from the study are in the public domain, even though they have not yet been peer reviewed. So I am able to share them in this discussion, Professor Matalon. And importantly, the data I am going to just speak on are from a population level matched cohort study that looked at the association between a vaccination for COVID-19 and then the outcomes in terms of miscarriage. And in this particular study, this referred to a loss of a pregnancy before 20 weeks of gestation, and also when a pregnancy was in the wrong place. By that, we mean an ectopic pregnancy, so a pregnancy not in the uterus, most commonly in the fallopian tube. In the study led by Professor Stock and colleagues, they were able to access electronic health records from all female residents in Scotland. And you've heard that Scotland has a population of some 5.5 million people altogether. And the female residents had been vaccinated between 6 weeks before conception and 19 weeks, 6 days. So that's up to 20 weeks. And Sarah, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we're talking here about a number of some 18,800 participants in this study. And then the other timeline was 2 weeks, 6 days gestation, and that is for the ectopic pregnancy. And the number of subjects there was 10,500. So these are big numbers of participants in the study. And when they looked at the data from unvaccinated women from pre-pandemic times as historical controls, and these were matched for age, gestational age at the time of the vaccination, the time of year when the conception took place, and other adjustments that might be considered risk factors, such as maternal deprivation level, rural or urban status, or clinical vulnerability, the reassurance was that the primary analysis found no association between vaccination and miscarriage or ectopic pregnancy. The rate of miscarriage after the COVID-19 vaccination was 9.1%, and after ectopic pregnancy, 1.2%. And I emphasize there was no association between vaccine and miscarriage or ectopic pregnancy. There was also no association between SARS-CoV-2 infection and miscarriage or ectopic pregnancy. And so to return to the important point that Professor Stock made when you asked her about COVID infection or vaccine, because the SARS-CoV-2 infection in later pregnancies carries such a substantial risk to women and their babies, the data on early pregnancy support the current recommendations that vaccine remains the safest way for pregnant women to protect themselves and their babies from COVID-19. So I hope I've represented that important study at preprint access correctly. And Sarah, please do add anything if you feel there's any additional message, because this is such an important message for women at whatever stage of their pregnancy, they should consider vaccination.
Thank you, Hilary. It is an important message. And I think it's just to reiterate that this is safety data that's backing up data coming out from other countries as well, that there is no safety concerns with vaccination and pregnancy.
Thank you both. This is an absolutely fantastic public message. and it can be of great help to a lot of pregnant women. Now, your most recent review on this topic with Dr. Reynolds as the first author is extremely informative. As you point out and summarize in table one, there are conflicting studies as to whether women that are pregnant are at a higher risk of being infected with the COVID virus and whether the virus may cross the placenta and infect the fetus. A number of viruses do, so this is a big concern. What is the general consensus at this time? And what should be watching for when reading the literature on this topic, which could be overwhelming? Professor Stock?
Oh, the literature can be overwhelming, can't it? And it changes all the time. But I think we can sort of say current consensus is that pregnant women, first of all, they're not more likely than other women to become infected with SARS-CoV-2 virus. So infection rates are similar, pregnancy or not pregnant. However, women are more likely to have severe COVID-19. For example, compared to non-pregnant women, non-pregnant women of similar age group, pregnant women are about three times as likely to be admitted to critical care and about three times as likely to require ventilation. There's strong and consistent evidence regarding it. It does seem that vertical transmission of SARS-CoV-2 can occur. However, if it does occur, it occurs rarely. I think we're quite clear that it's rare. And one way we can see this is if we look at infection in babies in the first month of life. And we've just released more data, and again in preprint, so not peer reviewed yet, but showing in our Scottish population data, where we've got whole population data, we're seeing very low rates of infection in babies in the first month of life throughout the pandemic period. An absolute risk of neonatal infection is less than 2% of women who have COVID around the time of birth. It's difficult for us to distinguish within that group how many of those babies might have had vertical transmission or transmitted from the mother, and how many actually had transmission from the family at home or within the hospital setting or caught SARS-CoV-2 after birth. However, the timing of infection, when we look at that study, suggests that the majority of infections were actually not vertical transmissions, but actually occurred after birth. So it seems that vertical transmission is rare. I mean, overall, when we look at infection rates, they were very low, but they did vary with peaks and troughs that we see in the general population levels as we see the waves of variants that we've seen. And for example, we could see in January 22, so the beginning of this year, when in Scotland we had extremely high levels of Omicron variant. In the UK, neonatal infections, they were less than tenfold the rates of 5 to 11-year-olds at that time. So in neonates, the rates were 650 per 100,000 neonates, and that's as opposed to infection rates of 8,000 per 100,000 children of school age. And in these babies, there were no ICU admissions where COVID-19 was the main diagnosis, and there were no deaths from COVID-19. So that's really reassuring that COVID-19 is infection in newborns tends to be mild. If we go back to thinking about COVID-19 in pregnant women, we do know that it can lead to complications in the baby, such as preterm birth and stillbirth. We think the consensus is, in the majority of cases, this is due to the pregnant woman becoming so unwell that it affects her developing baby. So sort of a generalized systemic infection, meaning that her baby might become unwell as well, or healthcare providers arrange early birth of her baby to help the maternal treatment. So what we're saying is that there tends to be a higher rate of indicated, provider-initiated preterm births rather than these births being driven by spontaneous preterm birth. However, there are emerging studies suggesting that placental infection with SARS-CoV-2 can occur in association with even mild infection. And this has been associated in case series with complications such as hypoxia, lack of oxygen to the baby in the womb, and even stillbirth. However, further research is really required, including studies in a larger number of women, to understand if these rare but serious outcomes can be associated with placental SARS-CoV-2. So I think sort of the take-home messages are it can occur, vertical transmission can occur. We think it's possible, but it seems to be very rare in practice. However, we need more research on this phenomenon of placental infection and to really understand whether that is a clinical problem that we need to consider.
Thank you very much, Professor Stock. That's highly informative. If I may, to change to a slightly different subject, a dreaded complication of pregnancy is the onset of severe preeclampsia. Is it likely that the SARS-CoV-2 virus or the following cytokine storm may damage or accentuate damage to the placenta and contribute to the development of preeclampsia? Also, if a woman is preeclamptic or has severe preeclampsia, is she more likely to suffer ill effects during a COVID infection? Are there any factors and or biomarkers that may contribute to SARS-CoV-2 development of preeclampsia?
Thank you, Sadis, for asking this question. I think it's a really important question. And I think there's been a lot of interest around whether COVID-19 would be associated with preeclampsia, because there's a potentially a really interesting biological mechanism whereby you could postulate that women who are predisposed to preeclampsia or who have COVID-19 might be at risk. And that's because of the potential impact of COVID on the weaning. I think what we know from the evidence is that actually there have been reported evidence of the associations between women with COVID-19 in pregnancy and then associated preeclampsia. But what we know is that maybe been subject to bias in the studies. And this is related to a number of different factors, maybe related to the fact that women who are at risk of preeclampsia are maybe more likely to be tested to see whether they have COVID-19. And then maybe the control population, the women who don't have preeclampsia or don't have COVID-19 and are not tested. And so this has led to a lot of uncertainty in the literature. I think it's quite possible to kind of postulate among women who are symptomatic with COVID-19 that there may be a position whereby the virus can lock on to the ACE2 receptors, who then produce the effects that you see with preeclampsia that will lead to central lesions. But it's harder for us to kind of think about women who are asymptomatic, whether that might be causing or being associated with preeclampsia. We still need more studies to really understand whether this is really a complication of COVID. So I think the jury is still out.
Thank you very much. This is such a severe outcome sometimes that we all interested in any possible side effects with preeclampsia. I would now like to turn to the treatment of pregnant women with COVID. Because of concerns of how drugs may affect the developing fetus, there has been a reluctance to include pregnant women in clinical trials of therapeutic interventions for COVID-19. What can you tell us about what the kind of treatments that are available and safe for pregnant women and COVID? Are there any animal models that these agents may be tested first?
Thank you. I think it's absolutely right that pregnant women are often purposefully excluded from trials of medication. And the effects of this are really illustrated in the pandemic, illustrated by the fact that women were excluded from trials of COVID-19 vaccines initially. So at the start of the vaccination program, there was a lack of good data to pregnant women and their caregivers to base decisions on. And that's likely to have contributed to high levels of vaccine hesitancy in pregnant women. And as we've discussed, this hesitancy has persisted, despite good evidence now that vaccines are safe and protect pregnant women and their babies from complications of COVID-19. So as a result of not including pregnant women, not even offering women the chance to take part in research, women and babies have died unnecessarily. And it doesn't have to be like that. Pregnant women can be included in drug trials. One of the successes of the pandemic is the recovery trial, a big, pragmatic, UK-based clinical trial of treatments for COVID-19. This was the first trial that showed steroids were an effective treatment for people with COVID-19. And this trial, the protocol, is an example of how pregnant women can be offered and will participate in clinical trials. Protocols were adapted so that pregnant women contributed to the data that has influenced the treatment guidelines worldwide. And steroids are life-saving with severe COVID-19, whether you're pregnant or not. So it's really important to say that pregnant women should be considered and included as standard in clinical trials rather than it to be the exception to the rule. Despite pregnant women contributing to the evidence about treatment, under-treatment is still a problem. So we've got, so from a UK study, this was a study from data from the whole of UK, found that less than 30% of pregnant women who were admitted to intensive care with COVID-19 during the Delta period received steroids as treatment. So this was at a time when it was clear that steroids could be life-saving. And if you look at, in contrast, rates of treatment in non-pregnant populations, they're around 80%. So showing that pregnant women, there still is a sort of culture of caution regarding drug treatments in pregnancy, even when evidence is there that it clearly indicates that under-treatment is more dangerous to the woman and her baby than any potential detrimental effects of drug itself. So I think we need to be including women in clinical trials. All new treatments require reproductive toxicity studies preclinically. So these are studies in animals. But we need a change in culture, I think, to ensure that it's the norm rather than the exception that pregnant women are included in trials of treatments, be they new trials or repurposed. So that's my thoughts on including pregnant women in clinical trials and developing treatments. But I'll hand over to Rebecca to discuss in more detail with the treatment options, the second part of your question about treatment options for COVID-19 in pregnancy.
Thank you, Professor Reynolds.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. I think that's a really helpful introduction. I mean, I think the really important thing is that we want to emphasise that pregnant women should be included in all treatment options and that we should be try to be as inclusive as possible in terms of thinking about what treatment options might be available. And you know, as Sarah indicated, in clinical trials, pregnant women are often excluded, but actually many of the treatment options that are available are totally suitable for pregnant women. I think it's really important to think about the woman as a whole and think about her as a patient and her baby as a patient and think about offering all treatment options.
Thank you very much, Professor Reynolds. Professor Stock, would you be so kind to give us a glimpse, if you will, of the exciting cutting-edge work that is being conducted in your institution and elsewhere on this topic?
We're continuing to work on this, and I say we, it is a collaboration between the University of Edinburgh and Public Health Scotland, and a team of researchers working on this. And our most recent work is related to viral variants, and this has just been accepted for publication and will be coming out soon. We've found that, thankfully, maternal and baby complications seem less common with Omicron variant than with Delta variant, where like in non-pregnant people, Delta variant was associated with particularly severe complications. We're also leading work using Scottish and UK data on vaccine safety, and then particularly looking at data with regards to congenital anomalies. So that's looking across the whole of pregnancy and just after birth, congenital anomalies. We're also looking at outcomes for mother and baby from infection. As Rebecca said, more numbers are needed to think about preeclampsia. So we're doing work on these maternal outcomes following COVID-19 in pregnancy. And really important to be thinking about following up the longer term outcomes after SARS-CoV-2 in pregnancy and during the pandemic in general. So those are the sort of work streams that we're working on through the COVID-19 in pregnancy in Scotland study, where much of this data has come from.
Wonderful. Professor Reynolds, would you like to add to this, please?
Yes, I think we're also looking at some of the wider impacts of the pandemic on pregnancy outcomes. So we're very aware that during the pandemic, pregnant women were understandably regarded as a vulnerable group, and so were encouraged to stay at home. And so one of the big impacts this has had is on the management of gestational diabetes, which is one of the most common complications of pregnancy. And so we're doing a very study across the whole of the UK to understand whether this change in our clinical practice of managing gestational diabetes has impacted on clinical outcomes, and whether our change to doing more remote monitoring of people with gestational diabetes, so doing virtual clinic appointments, has actually been okay in terms of their management. And I think, you know, we'll be hopefully publishing some outcomes of this work in the next few weeks. But that's a really important point, that actually, you know, the whole of antenatal care processes all changed during the pandemic, and we're really interested to know how that's impacted on the outcome.
Wonderful. Professor Critchley, would you like to add to this, please?
I just would like to thank Professor Stock and Reynolds, my colleagues, for speaking so detailedly about pregnancy. And I just want to expand the scope, as I know we'll be drawing our discussions to a close soon, to say that, of course, it's not just pregnancy that has raised concern, but also there is a very wide discussion about whether SARS-CoV-2 infection or COVID vaccination might impact on menstrual bleeding patterns. And this is an active area of research inquiry, and data are awaited from such studies. But just as we've heard how women were not included in the early opportunities for treatments or in trials, I think what this whole discussion is able to highlight is the need for questions about menstruation, about pregnancy history, and about reproductive health, which hitherto have not been routinely collected in clinical trials. We ask about respiratory symptoms, we ask about cardiac symptoms, we ask about gastrointestinal symptoms and urinary symptoms, but we just don't ask about reproductive health symptoms. And this really needs to be addressed. And I think most of the trials now going forward, and the regulators have become aware of this absence. And so trials going forward, in whatever context, should address these really important issues that are important for 50% of the population. Very quickly, the take-home general messages around menstruation and COVID-19 vaccination is that if cycle lengths are disturbed, they rapidly return to normal, usually by a couple of menstrual cycles after vaccination. And what we have to remember is that the normal pattern of menstrual cycles is variable in itself, and therefore any changes due to vaccination are really quite small and rapidly reverse. There's an interesting publication earlier this year in the Obstetrics and Gynecology field of journals, which did describe an association of a very short-lived minor alteration in cycle length. Changes in cycle or menstrual bleeding length were recorded in those receiving vaccination as compared with an unvaccinated cohort. And if there was a change in cycle length, it was probably only about in the order of a day, and there wasn't actually a change in the length of bleeding. So I think that if there are any changes, we still need to understand the mechanism by which these may come about. And important in all menstrual-related research is that there are so many other variables that have to be taken into account. A comment about COVID infection itself and menstruation and potentially long COVID. I know that there are studies looking at the effect of long COVID on menstruation experience. And again, if there is an impact, then we need to understand the underpinning biology. But I think what these few comments allow me to do is to emphasize that underpinning all of this is the absence to date of having included reproductive health measures in clinical trials. And I hope that that message is one that the regulators and those designing clinical trials can address and incorporate going forward.
Thank you very much. This has been an extremely informative discussion. And as far as I am concerned, it's a great public message to women, not only in the UK, but all over the world. Is there anything else you would like to add in the form of closing remarks? Professor Critchley, starting with you.
Of course, I would like to thank you, Professor Matalon, as our Editor-in-Chief of Physiological Reviews, for seeing this as an important topic for a podcast and for the support of the Physiological Reviews team in its preparation. And my colleagues, Professor Sarah Stock and Rebecca Reynolds in Edinburgh, for giving up time to join me. Importantly, a lot of the data shared, particularly from Edinburgh in the UK, would not have been possible without the funders of our research. So we must always recognise the importance of our funders. And also in this context, the patient and public involvement that we've had, which has been so important. I'll pass to Sarah because you may have some more specific thanks in terms of funders and other support aspects.
Yeah, we're really grateful for all the funding and support for the COVID-19 in pregnancy in Scotland study. This work is co-led by the Public Health Scotland and the University of Edinburgh. It's funded by Wellcome Trust and Tommy's Charity, and is part of a sub-study really of a wider study which is called EVE2, and we're particularly grateful to the EVE2 Parent and Patient Involvement Group and SANS Charity, which is a stillbirth and neonatal death charity, for their involvement in the work and the messaging around this. Other funders include the MRC, HDR UK, and the British Heart Foundation, we also fund aspects of Rebecca Reynolds and my work. So really to highlight that this work couldn't go on without the funding, we're very grateful to that.
Wonderful. Professor Reynolds, would you like to add something?
I would just like to endorse that actually we'd like to really give thanks to Tommy's and British Heart Foundation, and also all the work that we do is really endorsed with patient and public involvement, and we're really thankful to all the pregnant women who have taken time to contribute to our research questions and to help us with interpreting our research.
Professor Critchley, Professor Stock, and Professor Reynolds, personally, I cannot tell you how proud I am to be part of this podcast, and I would like to congratulate you for forming such an important team that addresses such an important health issue. Thank you. I know our listeners will find the conversation to be highly illuminating and valuable. We will include a link to your editorial in the episode description, and it is freely available in the Physiological Reviews website. Thank you again for your time and effort, and I look forward to many, many more future contributions.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you for listening to the Physiological Reviews podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate and review the podcast wherever you listen to it, and be sure to share it with your friends and colleagues. Check out our other articles and find other podcast episodes on our website at prv.org.